Good evening. This is Mark Dunley. We are a special edition of the Hudson Mohawk magazine here on WOOC 105.3 FM. We're mainly doing specials this week between Christmas and New Year's Eve. And so what I'm going to do today is a reflection and review of 2017. And we're going to start off with Mark Robarg, who is the city editor for the Troy Record, and we'll be talking about what took place here in Rensselaer County, City of Troy, over the last year. And then about 25 after the hour, we're going to get a pre-recording with Susan R. Better, the host of the Capitol Press Room from the Capitol, and we'll be talking more about what took place at the state level in 2017. And in the last 10 minutes or so, I'll do a quick 10-minute review of how we survived the first year of the Trump era. But we're joined now by Mark with the Troy Record. Good afternoon, or good evening, Mark.
Good evening. Have we really survived the first year of Trump?
Well, we're still talking. We're still alive. No one's been impeached yet, at least as far as I've heard. And how have you been surviving 2017?
Well, you know, it's been a very interesting but very entertaining year in Rensselaer County. A lot of good news, of course, a lot of bad news, as we're seeing right now with this this tragic quadruple homicide. But it's been a very newsworthy year, and I think a year in which the county started to take a step forward after what I thought has been a stagnant last couple of years.
At the county level you're talking about?
County and city level. County. I think politics kind of clogged everything up for the last couple of years, but I think what you saw near the end of this year, especially as the election cycle played out, that there's going to be some changes in the air next year.
Well, at the county level, of course, I mean, the big thing at the end of the year was the election of Steve McLaughlin as county executive to replace Kathleen Gimeno. He defeated the Democratic challenger, but he also, right after the election, even before the election, he got hit with some sexual harassment charges. And in fact, I guess some women are elected officials are asking him to step down. That doesn't seem like a great way to start off the year for his new administration.
No, it doesn't. And there are obviously some concerns because of the allegations that were out there. But I think, and I've talked to a few people about not just this specific case, but just in general, I think you're going to find now that with the spotlight being placed on this, I think you're going to see people being a lot more careful, even behind closed doors with this. And if anything, I think Steve is politically astute enough that he wouldn't allow himself to get into another situation like that, irregardless of whether it is or is not within his personality. I'm not judging innocence or guilt, simply political savvy.
So what were some of the big issues that framed the county executive race? And what are some of the big challenges he'll face as the new county executive?
Well, the challenges will not be very much different than the ones that faced Kathy Gimeno during her 16 years in office. She's been very vocal over the years in her opposition to these state-funded mandates that have put so much of a financial burden, not only on counties, but on cities and other municipal governments. I think that's always going to be a problem until they're done away with, because you're going to have to find ways to carve up an ever-decreasing piece of the pie to fill all these needs that aren't mandated for by the state but are still considered necessary, like maintaining roads. You know, you would think that's one of the prime functions of local government at all levels, yet it's not one of the mandated functions that is put down by the state or for which it's funded. The county has to find the funding. They get some CHIPS funding. That helps. They get some federal funding as well. But it's something where they're getting smaller and smaller amounts, and you'll see even less probably as the Trump administration moves along, as they've been cutting into so many state and local programming that they fund as well. So that challenge is not going to be any different. I think what may be different is I think you may see some new energy, some new approaches, some fresh ideas, simply because of the fact that you're getting some new people in the county office building. Of course, Steve has his own background in finance as well. So his ideas, I'm sure, will offer some fruit that could be done as well. But you also have to realize that for all of this, development continues to go along in the county, both within the city of Troy and outside the city of Troy, which is always going to offer that little bit of hope with the tax base that, at least outside the city, has continued to increase over the last few years and is still starting to show signs, solid signs of rebounding in the city, thanks to the development of the downtown area that's starting to spread out.
Now, one thing that doesn't get discussed a lot with counties is that actually under our state constitution, they are the administrative arm of the state. And so if there's any part of a local government that constitutionally should be expecting to be assigned various tax by the state, it is the counties. And you know, I certainly in my lifetime, we always hear about these unfunded mandates. But is that historically, you know, always been an issue, given that the role of the county is to be the administrative arm of the state? And largely what they do, though you probably don't know it much from, you know, listening to the campaign commercials, is they run social service issues. And increasingly, that means paying, you know, for Medicaid, which we hear a lot about. But primarily Medicaid is increasingly going to pay for the long-term care of senior citizens and other disabled individuals.
Sure, absolutely. My father is, as one example, somebody who's being paid for, being cared for through Medicaid.
You know, and I know another county issue that came up, not entirely under the purview of the county executive, has been the issue of, I guess the county sheriff has been looking at making some new arrangements with the immigration, the ICE, which has led to a lot of people speaking up at the county legislative meetings. Any idea how that's going to be played out?
That's a good question. It's something that's going to play out in the new year. As a matter of fact, Nick Bonanno, our county reporter, had a story this morning talking with the sheriff and with some of the opponents about the issue. And look, I understand what the opponents' concerns are. They don't want sheriff's deputies to basically be ICE deputies, if you will, so to speak, by joining this program by which they're trained to spot immigration infractions. And as a result, the city will be able to, or the city, excuse me, the county will have the opportunity to, at a very good price, house ICE prisoners as well. And, you know, anybody who follows county finances knows that the housing of inmates is a big moneymaker for the county. I believe the sheriff said this morning they're expected to make about $4 million just by inmates that they're housing through the U.S. Marshals Service. And he expects that that the ICE inmates could add significantly to that as well. So that's your one side of the issue. The concern about whether these officers would go out in the community, I respect that concern as well, because I think that's probably a big issue in general that the county is going to face this year is immigration enforcement. I know we have several people on the new council in the city of Troy who are supporters of the Sanctuary City movement and are probably going to push for that relatively early in the term. So it's a hot-button issue, but in talking to the sheriff, to him, it's nothing more than a financial issue, a way to make the county more money, and basically without any more responsibilities that he sees.
Well, I mean, apparently that led, however, the Albany County Sheriff to discover that, in fact, one did not need to be participating in the enforcement aspect in order to be renting out, you know, extra jail cells. And so I guess Albany County, the sheriff, after a lot of protests, decided to pull out of the relationship with ICE while still doing the you know, extra housing for the extra funds. Kind of sad that the county has to be, you know, putting people into jail cells in order to try to balance the budget. But the but a related issue, somewhat at least in terms of law enforcement, is that Rensselaer County district attorney has managed to get himself into a lot of hot water. In fact, he's now under indictment, I guess, for misleading the grand jury, not calling witnesses, and in terms of his rush a while back to allow a Troy police officer off the hook.
Well, in the grand scheme of things, I think this is probably going to end up being the most important story of the year. Whether it's the biggest story of the year or not, you'll have to find out in our Sunday paper. But I think this will end up being the most important story because this is probably going to have the widest reaching effect. You're talking about the district attorney basically challenged the governor's executive order that he put out in the face of all the police-involved shootings involving young black men, in which he basically authorized the Attorney General, Eric Schneiderman, to take over any investigation in any case in which you had an officer-involved shooting that involved a death of a civilian. And I'm trying to think. I don't think there was any other links to it. But anyway, the point being that the district attorney did not agree with the executive's order and basically went totally sideways, went against it, told the press, told everybody at that the day of the shooting that the attorney general's office had said they had no interest in prosecuting the case. Come to find out a couple of days later, that was not the truth. In the meantime, he pushed the officer's case, Sergeant Randall French, through a grand jury in 4 days. I've never seen anything in the legal system done in 4 days. I've had an uncontested divorce that took longer than 4 days. So the fact that he pushed it along that fast just kind of threw everybody's antenna up, and then to fight for everything to come through, the big court fight that resulted out of that with Schneiderman suing to get back jurisdiction over the case, and Abeloff finally giving it back after actually pretty good 2 months of back and forth. And then what followed, I think, just kind of went from there to the bizarre. You know, you're talking about now where he had withheld information, pertinent information from a grand jury. That's the allegation. It goes beyond what seemed initially like a political fight. It seemed to me like they were trying more, Republicans were more trying to put this executive order to a court challenge. And then it just went something beyond that. It almost became, in a sense to me, like a personal battle between Abeloff and Schneiderman, a duel of wills, if you will.
So you're listening to WOOC, and we're talking with Mark Robog, who is the city editor of the Troy Record. So we've been talking quite a bit about the county. What are some of the exciting things that happened this year right here in the city of Troy, the College City?
As we started to talk a little bit about before, I think the development aspect is one of the most exciting things going on in there. I mean, downtown Troy, and I know, Mark, you and I come from about the same time frame, and we both spent some time in Albany. So I think you might understand the analogy I'm giving as well. Downtown Troy is becoming a lot of what the Lark Street area in downtown Albany was back in the 80s when we were in college. It's becoming the hip place for not just college students, but that young professional group coming just out of college and like that. And the excitement, you can see it in the pages of our own paper. I mean, we still were at least 5 years into the renaissance here. We still are probably running 4 to 5 new business stories a day. And I would say at least half of them are about downtown businesses. So the fact that the excitement is still there, especially given all the fiscal problems the city has fought through over the last few years. And then the second part of it is the fact that, as started to say a little bit before, that development is starting to move up the river now. Now you've got those first signs of progress past past the Headley Building, past City Hall, and like that. You've got the artist loft apartments there. I can't remember what the name of it is. My apologies. But you also have the new hotel that's already, construction's already started on, plus the continuation of this whole almost boardwalk-style development that's surrounding the Headley Park Place building that's going to include another hotel, a developed boardwalk, better marina. All of this stuff is coming to fruition, and really, as I said before, the fact that this is going on while the city is struggling basically to stay above water fiscally just makes this even more incredible.
So how did the Monument Square development thing backfire so much and not work out?
Well, that you could blame on a competing developer who sued to block the development because he said it would infringe on his adjacent properties.
And this was a downtown cinema.
Yes, this was the downtown cinema proposal. The buildings on either side of that vacant lot are owned by Judge Development, Sam Judge. And what he was concerned about was that the development as proposed was going to restrict utility access to one of his properties, and was suing to block that. And basically it just got to the point with that and the opposition that Bonaccio Construction and Bowtie just said, look, it's not worth our effort, and they just backed off.
Now, in terms of obviously the city's finances not being in great shape, there was still basically a double-digit tax hike this year. And, of course, there was the whole fight over the so-called new fee for garbage, which, in fact, eventually did pass, and it spun off into a debate about whether or not we're going to get the volume-based garbage removal in the city. But how did that whole budget process work out?
Well, pretty much the same way that it did last year. The mayor compiled the budget proposal very quietly. I don't want to say secretively, but there was not a lot of information coming out of City Hall as the budget was being compiled, just as there really wasn't a lot last year as well. And once again, when the budget dropped, as it did last year, there was reactions of earthquake proportions, basically. A year ago, it was over the proposed 24.5% tax increase. This year, it was over, as you started to talk about, the proposed garbage fee, which takes the place of what would essentially be about a 14.5% tax increase, as we figured it after the budget was presented. It's been pared down now. The proposal now is, instead of the full $190 fee, it's only a $160 fee, and the mayor has agreed to sunset the fee at the end of 2018, which would give them a year to come up with this solid waste management plan they're talking about and implement a different version of a fee. They've said during the process that they favor a pay-as-you-go fee instead of the flat fee that's being proposed now. Of course, that's the pay-as-you-go fee. Is the whole idea behind that is you're going to encourage more people to recycle, compost, or use other alternative means of disposal if they, as well as the city, see the direct savings. They feel with opponents feel with the flat fee that there's no incentive for you and me and the other users out there to change our habits in any way at all. So they have said that was what they would like to see eventually, but they want to put this fee in, quote unquote, for the time being while the plan is developed. Now, of course, the other shoe that dropped a couple of weeks ago was finding out that the mayor had been approached by state officials with some sort of a promise that if they could come in with a balanced budget and do it without exceeding the tax cap, which is less than 2% for the city, then the oversight board would consider forgiving, I guess is the word they use, some of the $25 million in debt the city has been paying down since 1994 after they went pretty much belly up back then. So that's the new factor now. So everybody's obviously wondering now, well, is this really you know, as the mayor says, an idea on how to push recycling, how to cut the city's trash collection costs, or is this just a backhanded way to get that money from the state and still not have to cut out a lot of stuff in the budget that he would have to cut out otherwise?
Well, we only got about 5 minutes left, unfortunately. What went on with the city council races? Obviously, the Democrats now have a slight majority control, though a Republican still is the city council, president. You know, Troy is viewed politics as sort of a blood sport. Is there any sense that we got a city council now that's going to perhaps be a little bit more focused on how to develop the city and respond to some of the community concerns?
Well, honestly, if you look at it from a historical perspective, it probably shouldn't be such a huge surprise that the Democrats took back the majority. The reason they lost their majority 2 years ago, and that came before I even started here. I started 2 days after Election Day. But in talking to people and looking back over it, it wasn't so much that the Republicans won the majority. It's that the Democrats lost the majority because there was such a bitter division right down the ranks through that election campaign, going right back to the election, the primary battle between Patrick Madden and Rodney, the city council president. Sorry. And that really divided the party up. You had a much more progressive wing and a much more old school wing that were just clashing. And I think they just split the party so badly that it opened the door for the Republicans to walk through. This year, if you look at the candidates that were elected from the Democratic Party, you're looking at that progressive base of the party that basically won the battle, finally put their ticket up, and they were able to do what the party wasn't able to do 2 years ago.
Who are some of the city council members you're looking forward to covering in the next year and might come forth with some innovative ideas?
Well, I'll tell you, the new one I look most forward to, and it's just as much because of his personality as his politics, is Inasha Cummings. He is the new representative in the 4th District. He's replacing Bob Dougherty.
Had a big Santa Claus holiday postcard.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I got mine. I added it to my collection. But he's a very positive politician, which, you know, you don't see a lot of in the city of Troy over the years. He's coming in with a very positive attitude. He wants to hear from everybody. He wants to work with everybody. And I honestly, from seeing and hearing him, I really believe that it's sincere. My question is how that's going to hold up when he faces the old school politics of the incumbent council president, Carmela Mantella, who is as old school in her politics as it comes. And I'm sorry to say it, but will probably try to do anything she can from the city council president's seat to obfuscate the council majority next year.
Hmm. So we got about 2 minutes left. What else took place in the city of Troy or even Rensselaer County at the local levels in the last year that we should not forget?
Well, just to look across the river, I mean, you've had some great development in Cohoes. And I know they don't get a lot of credit. We try to give them more coverage in the paper than a lot of others do. But for all that's going on, and you can put the controversy involving the mayor aside, and even though you had this tragic fire on Remsen Street a few weeks ago, that city has also started to find new life. The downtown has got a lot more excitement to it. The music hall has just blossomed so well under the partnership with the palace and now going with the former executive director. Cohoes is just a beautiful growing place. And if you haven't been over there, I'd say take the time and cross the river for a few minutes.
And you got the Cohoes waterfall over there, which actually has more water going over it than over the Niagara River waterfall in Niagara Falls.
Yes. Yes, it is one of my kids' favorite places to go when I take them over there.
Hmm. Well, Mark, we want to thank you for joining us here on WOOC, and we look forward to talking to you more in the coming year.
Always my pleasure, Mark. Have a good evening.
Yep, thank you. So up next, we're going to be talking with Susan Arbetter in a pre-recorded interview. Susan is the, main spokesperson for Capitol Press Room and covers state politics at the state capitol on a daily basis. And so we got about 25 minutes with Susan talking about, what are some of the key developments at the state level in the last year. This is Mark Dunley, and we're talking with Susan Arbetter, one of the top reporters at the state capitol. And we're going to talk to Susan about what are some of the key things that happened in New York State during the 2017 session. Let's start off with the budget. What were the big issues in the budget, and how did they end up getting resolved?
It was a weird year. You might remember that back in January of 2016, the governor's state of the state was notable for something that happened with an assemblyman by the name of Charles Barron, downstate Democratic assemblyman. He heckled the governor because of his lack of investment in education aid. So last year, in 2017, the governor decided not to do the similar kind of state of the state, and instead did a series of regional state of the state addresses.
That was quite controversial. A lot of the state legislators weren't particularly happy to have him running out of the Albany.
And you have to remember, he was, this was one of the times when he was very unpopular and certainly not popular among the legislative community. So this coming year, the governor will go back to the traditional, joint session and one state of the state. But last year, he did not do that. And he also presented, in his the issues were sort of geared toward each region of the state that he visited. Like on Long Island, he talked about Long Island issues, for example. But there were certain issues that there were threads between all six or seven regional state of the state addresses. One of them was raising the age of criminal responsibility, which is basically New York was one of the only states. I think North Carolina is the other one that were 15 or 16 and you would be convicted as an adult. And he has changed that. That was one of his proposals, and he successfully changed it.
Now he's changed it up to 18.
That's exactly right. 17.
With some exceptions.
Yeah, there's a lot of exceptions to this. But broadly speaking, the age was raised. And that is not in effect yet. So if you are a kid and you do commit a crime now.
Behave this holiday season.
Yeah, exactly. It's not going to go into effect, I think, until next October. A couple other big issues that were presented universally at all of these state of the states. Free college tuition, that Excelsior scholarship program. Ride hailing was successfully passed.
But let's on the free college tuition. That was fairly controversial because it didn't really assist the lowest income New Yorkers. It didn't deal with, like, for instance, books or other fees that they're paying.
It
really was a middle class program.
In many ways, yes. And
he brought Bernie Sanders in to support that.
Yes, he did. He brought Bernie Sanders in. And this is, right after the big campaign. And Sanders was running for president and very popular here in New York. And it's a last dollar program wherein you get all of your TAP and your grants and your student loans. And then you get whatever's left over, that gap is filled in by the state. It's still very controversial.
You must commit to stay in the state for 3-4 years after you graduate?
And you have to graduate within 4 years. Right. And you have to have a certain course load in order to do that. So there's a lot of rules.
It's always been a problem in New York State that a lot of working class people don't graduate in 4 years because they can't afford necessarily to do that quickly after.
I don't know about you, Mark, but when I was in college, I worked. I had an internship, and I was lucky enough to graduate in 4 years. But there are a lot of kids that aren't as fortunate, and they have to work in order to pay for the next semester's tuition.
Right.
And you also have a room and board. You have books. You have fees up the wazoo, right? So it's a difficult. So definitely middle class sort of priority. We mentioned ride hailing, so we have Uber and Lyft now. Another issue is that we had we passed a pretty big paid time off program for parents and caretakers. And if you have a family member who is sick and you need to take care of them, New York has one of the most generous paid family leave policies.
And
now.
That starts January 1st, I believe.
That's exactly correct. Also, he put a priority on offshore wind programs and protecting drinking water, thanks to the what happened in Hoosick Falls with the PFOA and the PFOS.
Well, on what exactly did he propose on offshore wind? Because we did get a very small project out of LIPA, under 100 megawatts, and we're really looking at the big Saudi Arabia of offshore wind for the world is off of Long Island. And we did eventually get, I think a Norwegian company, Statoil, came in and outbid the state. The state had wanted to control the process, but the Statoil came in, outbid the state, and now they apparently are going to build the offshore wind project in Europe, not in the United States, and then ship it to the United States so the jobs primarily go to Europe.
So you know more about this than I do. I know that he has big plans for decarbonization. I'm not sure where the rhetoric stops and the action begins, but there is a gap between rhetoric and action here, apparently, according to many of the environmentalists I've spoken with, including you.
Correct.
Yeah. So all of these issues, or many of these issues, were successfully negotiated in the budget. It was a pretty good year for the governor, I think. He also fended off reforms to his economic development programs, and that, of course, is in the wake of all the convictions that took place. Or not the convictions, the allegations of wrongdoing. We'll talk about convictions later.
Okay.
So most of the issues were negotiated peacefully, but there were a couple of outstanding issues at the end of the budget negotiation. I don't know if you remember this, that the budget was actually late because there were two outstanding issues: mayoral control of schools in New York City for Mayor de Blasio and the county sales tax extenders. And they were conflated in Albany the way many issues are. And the Senate Republicans, who were no fan of de Blasio, who wanted to kick them out of power, said, well, yeah, we'll give you 3 years of mayoral control, but...
So they're trying to extract something from...
Education investment tax credit. Okay, I just had to get it straight. So, and that's...
And that's for private schools, parochial schools.
Catholics, churches, yeshivas, they had all been lobbying for, and which public schools say would be a direct taxpayer... It would direct taxpayer money away from public schools. So the Assembly, which is very much pro-public school, very much for the unions, said no, we're not going to do that. Ultimately, the Assembly sort of won a little one but lost the war in terms of a shorter extension of mayoral control. They did get sales tax extenders, but no education tax credit. That's all good for the Assembly, but at the last minute, the governor and the state Senate threw in the ability of some charter schools to create an alternative certification program. And the SUNY Charter Schools Institute did indeed vote on that, and that's going to happen right now.
And did not the governor renew the millionaire's tax perhaps a little bit earlier than anticipated?
I don't know. I don't recall that. Okay, I'm sorry. I think that, yeah, I will have to look at that.
Because that will certainly be a big issue in the upcoming year because we have this $4 billion, you know, deficit coming up.
We have a $4.4 billion, could be $6.8 billion, budget gap. Many of the people I've spoken with, including Coral Hastie, who's the Speaker of the Assembly, says they are not going to include another millionaire's tax. That's especially in light of, you know, what happened at the federal level. But if you are a winner under the federal tax budget or the tax overhaul, you could see a tax increase, whoever the winners may be.
Uh-huh.
He was not specific. But like pass-through companies, corporations.
And wealthy individuals.
But
doesn't want to do the personal income
tax. He doesn't want to do the PIT tax. Right, exactly. Right. So, but after the budget, there was the summer of hell.
With the MTA.
Yeah, so you've been in New York City way more than me. Has it been that bad?
Well, I was not really there a lot last year. It's been increasingly bad. Basically, more and more people have been riding the subway or would like to ride the subway, but the service has definitely been deteriorating. The percentage of on-time subways has been decreasing, and the weekends are just horrible because that's when they end up doing all the work, and so you can never figure out where the subways, you know, are going. And,
how frustrating.
And certainly it's not, you know, rush hour, end up waiting 45 minutes to an hour for it. So it's really a, you know, a big problem. And the summer was even worse.
So the issue here is that, you know, the New York Times did this huge expose about divestment in the MTA and the subway. And the governor who is in charge of the subway, apparently, is to blame for much of
this. Not the state legislature?
No, not
the mayor?
Even you're joking because that's what he keeps finding different people to blame. Right. But in fact, he is truly in charge of that transit system and can do a lot more. And a couple years ago, he redirected money to some upstate ski areas from the MTA, and people were pretty pissed about that.
Well, the other thing a lot of us have complained about in New York City was that they tended to build new stations. And so you would literally spend billions of dollars to put some shiny thing on top of the subways, but then do nothing for the subways below that. Like, and my work site, which is very close to the World Trade Center, you know, they spent like $1.5 billion to redo the Fulton Avenue stop, which is one of the major hubs in the city, but it was still a labyrinth that unless you used it every single day, you cannot figure out. And that's sort of the concern, that money was going to these shiny projects and money was not going in to maintain the subway lines and the subway trains.
Right. Well, you know, it's not sexy. It's the same exact argument that Mayor Stephanie Miner has been making, that the water mains in Syracuse explode every single day when it's freezing in the wintertime. But to fix or invest in a water main is just not something that a governor can stand and cut a ribbon around, so it's not.
But water was one of the issues. They did put quite a bit of money into the budget.
Yeah,
last
several
year.
Million dollars, and
it's billion. I thought
billion dollars. Right. I apologize, and this would be investment over several years, and basically this is to for clean water testing. This is for a variety of things around water, and much of it came after the political pressure from what happened in Hoosick Falls, which is where the water was contaminated with PFOA due to, manufacturing that took place there. And Newburgh as well, and Petersburg. I mean, and there's lead, you know, in the water.
And
there's
a lot of stuff. The more you look, the more places you find with problems.
Absolutely. So I wanted to get to a couple of things. I mean, before the election, I believe it was the sexual harassment, the Harvey Weinstein expose in the Times came out, and that has had somewhat of an effect here in Albany in the wake of, you know, Sam Hoyt, for example, mm-hmm. former assemblyman and economic development aide in Western New York, somebody who Governor Cuomo spoke well of and Howard Zemsky, his immediate boss, spoke well of. He quit, and it turned out later that he had to leave because of a sexual harassment scandal. And the governor was asked recently what he could have done differently to address that behavior. And instead of responding in just a straightforward way, he turned the question around and asked the reporter, who was a woman, Karen DeWitt from New York Public Radio, who's been here for like 30 years, turned it around and said to her, well, what are you going to do to address sexual harassment in journalism? His point was that sexual harassment isn't only something that happens in state government, but it was done in a very clumsy way. And Ken Lovett of the New York Daily News, who really is one of the best reporters in Albany, wrote a column last week that said this could affect Governor Cuomo's future political aspirations.
Well, in Rensselaer County, the related issue is that Steve McLaughlin, who just got elected as Rensselaer County legislator, county executive, had been a state assembly member, and that had been part of the campaign, a lot of complaints about his treatment of his female staff people. But after the election was over with and he was elected, Then the assembly came out and said, oh, by the way, we had this little complaint against Steve on sexual harassment. And now that he has gone someplace else, now we're going to sanction him and show him how tough we are.
He is going to ascend to the county executiveship, but there are many women who are saying that he needs to step down.
Right.
Ironically, it was just prior to the episode with the governor and Karen DeWitt that he released his very first State of the State proposal for 2018, and that is taking guns away from convicted abusers who engage in domestic violence. There are a bunch of other bills in the ether to address sexual harassment as well. All of them are, as far as I know, all of them are sponsored by women. Sandy Galiff wants to make sure that all the sexual harassment policy in New York State is the same. Like, it's a universal policy. Everybody is going to, like, the buck stops with everybody, basically. Another one would prevent economic development money from going to companies that have a secret history or a history of sexual harassment. I'm sorry. And another one would prevent secret settlements with victims of sexual harassment. So that's going to be a lot of the conversation is going to revolve around sexual harassment in 2018.
Now, earlier you'd mentioned corruption, but we didn't really get a lot into that. We did have the situation, of course, where both the former Speaker of the Assembly and the Senate Majority Leader had been convicted of corruption, and those things were overturned. There was a lot of hope that this would be the session, finally, where, in fact, corruption would be dealt with, and ethics reform, and campaign finance.
It was our Watergate moment, right?
Right. How did that work out?
Yeah, it was not the Watergate moment. It was like a moment of the big meh, nothing happened. Things could change this year. Every month between January and June, there is some sort of corruption trial that's going to take place, starting in January with Joe Prococo, who is, the governor's called him my father's third son, who I think he loved the most. I mean, this is somebody who's very close to the governor, was with him back in 2002 when he ran for governor the first time. It's alleged that he took bribes and engaged in bid rigging. In February, we have former Senator George Maziarz. In March, we have former Nassau County Executive Ed Mangano, who was a Cuomo ally. And we have, I think he's the Oyster Bay former Oyster Bay Mayor John Venditto. They were engaged in some sort of bribery, soliciting bribes, kickbacks, things like that. In April, Sheldon Silver is supposed to be retried sometime in April, and he
former Assembly Speaker
for years and a huge powerhouse in Albany. And he was initially convicted in December of 2015 of getting kickbacks from a law firm in the form of these referral fees, and then using taxpayer money to pay for the research of a cancer doctor who made those referrals. In June, the retrial of Dean Skelos, who is the former majority leader, will take place. And he was initially convicted in December 15th on 8 counts of bribery, extortion, and corruption along with his son. Both Silver and Skelos get retrials because their convictions were overturned thanks to the narrowing of the definition of corruption by the Supreme Court in that infamous McDonnell case. And in between Silver and Skelos, in May, you have Alan Calleros, who's the former nano czar and former head of SUNY Poly, and he has been charged with bid rigging. So every single month, pretty much, there's something in the ether that could come back to bite Andrew Cuomo in the butt, because even though he wasn't charged with anything, Andrew Cuomo, it can't be good for him, because it will remind voters that his economic development plans have been expensive, they've been troubled, they could have been a waste of money, and maybe his leadership is questioned.
Well, will that open up the door to have, greater scrutiny, greater job reporting requirements, and also when they fail to produce the jobs they're supposed to, which is often the case, that in fact they'll have to give some of that money back.
Right, clawbacks. And you're talking, of course, about reforms to the economic development programs. They need transparency. We need this database of deals. The controller wants to have some oversight that the legislature took away from him a few years ago. He wants it back. All of these things are critically important to many people in the legislature. They pushed it hard last year. The governor somehow got around it, and it didn't happen last year. It's still on the minds of many people this year. We'll see.
Well, and you're speaking about pushing about things, and we've got about 5 minutes left at this point. How are our good friends at the IDC doing in terms of propping up the Senate Republicans? And
okay. The IDC is the breakaway group of Democrats, but they do enable the Senate Republicans to maintain power. There is this deal we heard yesterday from mainline Democratic leader Andrea Stewart-Cousins that Governor Cuomo is the architect of this deal that they hammered out last month between all the parties, that if certain things happen by April, basically.
After the budget.
Okay. If certain things happen after the budget, then the two groups will unify. Nothing is being said about Simca Felder, who's sort of this like third, he's like another issue that they have to deal with. He's not made any promises whatsoever. But in order to give the Democrats 32, they would need Simca's agreement to join them. So we'll see what happens. You know, it doesn't sound like everyone is 100% on board.
One last thing, just getting back to the ethics reform and campaign finance. I was actually somewhat surprised to hear recently that Suffolk County has enacted campaign finance reform, very similar to the New York City model. And, you know, so that's sort of a Republican bastion out there. Was one of that might be.
Well, let me just tell you this, that Suffolk County has been just, it's a bastion, all right. It's a bastion of corruption, not just Republicans. I mean, this is Republicans and Democrats. Their district attorney, Thomas Spoda, had to step down because of all kinds of allegations. He's being investigated. And they now have a new district attorney. They have they are trying to clean up their own house, but the Democratic county executive is definitely a law and order type person who is into clean elections, Steve Ballone, because of what happened with Spoda, who is his enemy. And that's what I got.
That's what you have. How did this impact? So you think that Cuomo came out looking pretty good during the 2017
he got cycle. A lot of what he wanted, really, Mark. You know, in terms of raising the age, that was a huge victory, I think. Even though there are some people who wanted a more, you know, I don't want to say a better piece of legislation, but a piece of legislation that might have been more to the liking of downstate Democrats. But the fact is that in politics, you've got to do these negotiations, and they got it done over a lot of protesting Republicans.
Right. Now, you know, the person we haven't talked about more at the federal level, of course, is the new president, a New Yorker, Donald Trump.
Is he new anymore?
Still in the first year, in the honeymoon phase, so to speak. But he has wreaked havoc, apparently, on the New York State financial situation.
Well, there's a lot of things we don't know, all right? But the financial, we already know that having nothing to do with Donald Trump and nothing to do with the federal budget, that New York is in. A bad situation. We have a gap, probably the biggest gap since 2008. It's somewhere between, you know, if he keeps spending at 2%, it's probably going to be about, you know, $1.7 billion. But even though he said, Governor Cuomo, that he's kept spending at 2%, he hasn't really. It's, you know, he finds ways of putting things off the books and a little gimmicking and, you know, one shot, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So we probably have a budget gap of about $3.5 billion that he's going to have to fill, which means cuts are coming.
Right. But I was just reading yesterday that the state has a record number of enrollment in the Obamacare, you know, medical exchange, over 4 million. Presumably, under some of the changes coming down at the federal level, some of that funding for those 4 million may be disappearing. So
We got cuts that are possibly coming if New York decides to maintain some of these programs.
Absolutely. Right. The essential plan is at issue. We're going to run out of money for Child Health Plus in March. Medicaid is on the chopping block. Medicare is on the chopping block. There's a lot of unknowns when it comes to health care.
So, Susan, if people want to hear your show normally, where do they hear that here in the Capital?
They can even hear it abnormally, and they can do that at WVCR 88.3 FM from 5 to 6 p.m. So 88.3 FM, 5 to 6 p.m. And we're all over upstate New York at different nonprofit, commercial, community, and NPR stations.
Well, thank you very much, Susan Arbetter, and this has been Mark Dunley for WOOC.
And you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy. We're doing a special holiday edition, and I want to thank Jonah and Olivia for coming in and helping to engineer today. To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. So we started off with Mark going over what was going on at the city and county level, and then moved on to Susan going into the state level. And so for the last 9 minutes or so, we're going to talk a little bit about what happened at the national level in 2017. And many of you think back to where you were a year ago, you know, might have been rolled up in the corner in a fetal position as we move towards the inauguration of Donald Trump as, our president. I guess he felt that it was the largest inauguration in history. Apparently, he likes to count empty spaces as representing a large mob. And, you know, so we sort of led off the whole year with this whole idea that a president, I guess, lies a lot. How else do you say it? And we had some rather rapid turnover among some of the key individuals in the Trump administration. I think Mike Flynn, as a national security advisor, didn't quite last 3 weeks and set sort of a record, you know, for that. One of the very inspirational moments was the day after the inauguration. Many of us participated in the Women's March, initially started out as an event in D.C., which, you know, attracted, you know, several hundred thousand people. But Women's March is sprung up all over the country. I participated in one in New York City, organized in a few weeks' notice, that attracted 400,000. I know there was one here in the Capital District. And we saw a lot of really big marches during the first 6 months of the year here in the Capital District. I remember going out on a Saturday morning to John Faso's office in Kinderhook. He's the congressman who replaced Gillibrand eventually. And, you know, there were 600 people out in front of his office protesting over his attacks on, you know, Obamacare. And, you know, that was quite incredible. And then the climate march took place with about 200,000 people. Unfortunately, a lot of that level of protest has not continued. But people are certainly very looking forward to the midterm election next year and whether or not there will be the possibility of actually replacing both the United States Senate and the House of Representatives with another party. Related to, you know, Mr. Trump and Mr. Flynn, obviously one of the big issues of the years was the ongoing investigation, the Mueller investigation into corruption. I guess they started off with the issue of collusion in the most recent presidential election between the Trump campaign and allegedly the Russian Mr. Putin's operation. Though more recently, I've always felt that was more likely they were going to get President Trump for financial shenanigans, particularly some of his relationship with Russia. And in fact, most recently, it's come to light that, in fact, Mueller has subpoenaed the bank records from Deutsche Bank in Germany, which largely it seems to have been a laundering operation for the Russian mob and the Russian government. So that, in fact, may end up being the downfall of the Trump administration, not the potential collusion with Russia in the elections, but the ongoing relationship with Russia as a way to finance his real estate empire. Certainly another key issue that took place during 2017 with the Trump administration was the belligerent attitude with North Korea on the issue of nuclear weapons. People may remember that. In fact, we never actually have ended the war with North Korea. So for 60 years, we have refused to sign an agreement with them. That kind of leads them to be a little sense of paranoid on that. One of the other big issues with the Trump administration has been his ongoing attacks on the climate, starting with his Mr. Pruitt, the former Attorney General of Oklahoma, being appointed to head up the Environmental Protection Agency. A lot of concern that the Trump administration had pulled out of the climate change agreement, COP21, in Paris. Certainly there's been an effort to try to get individual states to step up to that. Attorney General Schneiderman here in New York has filed a number of lawsuits against the Trump administration for violating the law on some of the efforts they've made to roll back regulations, because regulations on the environment come out of laws that have been passed. So you can't just get rid of the regulations if the underlying laws have not been changed. On the congressional level, early on, the big fight was over the repeated efforts by the Republicans to get rid of Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. They tried many times, but ultimately fell a few votes short of doing that. On a related note, there seems to be an increase in support for a universal single-payer health care system. And here in New York, in fact, Governor Cuomo came out in favor of it. Senator Gillibrand joined with others, Senator Sanders, to introduce a single-payer bill in the Senate. There's been one for many years with more than 100 co-sponsors in the House, but it's the first time there's a robust at the single-payer at the Senate level. Just recently, Congress did enact what's considered one of the biggest tax ripoffs in American history, a tremendous transfer of wealth to the wealthy. Surprise, surprise. Certainly throughout the year, the issue of sexual harassment has become a major concern with, I guess, Harvey Weinstein and others in the entertainment business. The Me Too movement was Times Person of the Year. And, you know, one wonders, as we, same as we saw with same-sex marriage a couple of years ago, whether in fact the issue of sexual harassment actually has become a real fundamental change in society and not just a passing media fad. Unfortunately, once again, mass killings took place. They, in fact, have become so numerous that we, you know, forget about them. The big one being in Las Vegas, where 51 people were murdered, another 26 in Texas, other large ones taking place in California. The number of mass killings are, in fact, incredible. Unfortunately, it's not yet led to any change in the gun laws at the federal level. Hurricanes was a big news, you know, initially hitting the Gulf Coast with Texas and Florida. Force level 5 hurricanes, not seen that many previously. And then the really big ones hit in Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands, the Caribbeans. And in Puerto Rico, people still, you know, more than half of the population of 3 million who are American citizens still do not have access to electricity, may not get electricity for another 5 or 6 months, and many of them still have problems getting access to water. That does seem to have changed the perception about climate change, as well as, of course, the ongoing wildfires in California, which remain a catastrophe. Some would say probably the, you know, one of the biggest news stories of the years was that on 9/11, the Hudson Mohawk News Magazine went on air for the first time, and we've been managed to do a nightly show for the last five nights a week, and so you can join us and catch us in, and we need you know, more donations to support it. I do want to thank Jonah and Olivia for helping us out and being the engineers. This concludes our show. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. To learn more about this program and how you can support the Sanctuary of Independent Media, feel free to visit our website at mediasanctuary.org.